I'm in LA, so it's 9 a.m. on a Sunday.
Oh, we're so sorry.
No, it's okay. It's fine.
Are you calling in? Are you on a computer? Can you see us?
I can see you, yeah. Yeah, but believe me, you don't want to see me.
Live from the Talking Joe Studios, it's Talking Joe.
G.I. Joe, the very best, America's elite. Eliter than all the rest, trained to have no flaws. Defending liberty across the land, valor oversized. Bring out that big brass band, real heroes verified. Gotta read them all, you must agree. Elitist in history,
G.I. Joe.
Oh, there could be no end in a world we must defend.
G.I. Joe,
gotta read them all. A courageous crew, their colors red, whites, and blue. Mess with them and they'll shoot you. G.I. Joe,
gotta read them all.
Gotta read them all.
Hey, 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 it's me, Mark, and welcome to Talking Joe, everyone's favorite G.I. Joe comics podcast. Today, we are talking with Joe Casey. Joe is a comics writer who has worked on books such as X-Men, Cable, Adventures of Superman, Wildcats, and so much more. He's co-created characters such as America Chavez at Marvel, his own books such as Godland and Butcher Baker. And he is also one of the creative team, Man of Action, and co-creators of Ben 10. But most importantly for us, he wrote G.I. Joe America's Elite 0 through 18 in 2005 and 2006. And joining me to talk to him will be my co-host, it's Real American Tim, it's Tim Finn.
Hello, Mark, and hello, listeners. I'm coming to you from my brother's basement in Maryland because I'm on a little family trip.
Excellent.
And I'm very excited to talk to our guest. So let's jump in.
Here we go. It's Joe, the writer that we loved so much that we named our podcast after him.
Very curious. Yeah, but I think I got the joke there.
Good stuff. Where are you joining us from today?
The shadowy depths of Los Angeles, California.
Have you always been a West Coast guy? Were you ever a New York guy or a Midwest guy?
No, I grew up in the Southeast. I grew up in Tennessee, and I moved out to L.A. About 30 years ago.
As a as an opening question, because I think a lot of comics people only think of you as a comics person. Can you tell us about Man of Action?
Well, it's a sort of creative collective, a mobile writer's room. We all met doing comics. We all started out working together on the X-Men franchise at Marvel. Then we all quickly migrated over to the Superman franchise at DC. And the party line is we had trouble working on the franchises, but loved working with each other. So we decided in a very prescient move that we would join forces and see if we could make our way in Hollywood as a, you know, strength in numbers kind of fashion. That was back in 2000, I think. And so after a couple of, not false starts, but sort of work tangents, we finally landed and or created Ben 10 at Cartoon Network in about 2005. It took a couple of years to get on the air. And then from there, we were off to the races. We went down a animation rabbit hole that we're still in, and we've occasionally branched out into live action features and TV and things like that. So it was a long game bet that actually worked. Can't believe it.
You used the word writers, like a writers collective, a writers room. When I look at the list of names, one or two of them, I think, comic book artists.
Well, Duncan Rouleau draws comics. He's a great, great artist, but he's also a writer as well. And the other three of us are just writers.
Okay. And it's always been the four of you. You haven't, it's not a rotating door, revolving door.
Well, we've assembled over the years sort of a duty roster of writers that we work with, because a lot of times we've got multiple shows going at once. So just to delegate authority, we have to hire writers underneath us to you know, execute episodes. And we've always got our hand on the wheel, but sometimes the workload is just too much. So we, you know, over the last, you know, 20 or so years, we've got a pretty big stable of other freelancers that we can call on if we need them, and people we learn to depend on and know how to work with us, and we know how to work with them. So it's kind of a bigger organization than the four of us alone suggests, but we had to do it. There were times where we would have three or four shows in production, and you know, none of us were keen on writing all of it. So we had to bring in people to support us and help us out. It's always generally our voice that you're hearing, but we get a lot of help along the way.
And when you introduce yourself, do you say, I'm Joe Casey, I'm a writer? Do you say, I'm an executive producer? Do you say, content creator? Or do you say, I'm a man of action? What's your job description?
It depends on the gig. You know, if they need a writer, I'm a writer. If they need somebody to perform EP duties, I'm an EP. If they need somebody to create content, I'm a content creator. It's a very fluid kind of a deal in Hollywood. You go where the money is, and you perform the duties that you need to perform in that circumstance. If you ask me personally, I'm a writer, but sometimes that in Hollywood, that's can be the low man on the totem pole. So you don't always want to lead with that.
So we are heading back to the heady days of 2005 today. So, Joe, how do you feel your memories of what is now quick maths 18 years ago? How do you think that bears up?
It's not bad. I pulled out all the trades, the three trades, and kind of refreshed my memory. And I found, oddly enough, it wasn't that difficult to find, the original pitch notes that I sent in to Josh at Devil's Due. So I've got that little artifact I can excerpt from if the need arises.
Nice. I think the need will arise.
Okay, then.
I'm curious, is that how many pages is that? Is that a summary of the 18 issues?
It was about 7 pages, and it was sort of an overview of my thoughts on the franchise and the property, and I think I got through about the first year's worth of stories. And you know, they changed from this document, you know, in some ways, which we can talk about a little bit. But I had the first two storylines in mind when I came up with the pitch and the approach, and then the third one with the Phoenix Guard and Cobra Commander as the chief of staff, that came later as I was writing the book. Uh-huh. Spoilers, by the way.
if our listeners and viewers are following along, Mark, we'll post this after.
Yeah, we'll post this after we've talked about issue 18. Yeah,
right.
So yeah, if they've been listening along as we've gone, then there's, you know, they should be up to date in terms of us talking about 18. So we should be fine with spoilers. And if you're still finding stuff to be spoiled, then shame on you for not listening to the previous episode, listener.
Devil's true, our poo is all I want to know right now. True, or boo. Let's find out the answers right now.
I asked you to have a think about any surprising facts that may or may not be true for our segment, Devil's Due or Devil's Poo. So you're going to give us what might be a fact, which seems a little bit surprising, and me and Tim will have a guess as to whether we think it is something that is true or something that is poo. Joe, over to you.
Okay, this is not an earth-shaking revelation, but one of the things that Josh told me was sort of sacrosanct, that if I was going to take the gig, I'd have to deal with this, was that he wanted to bring in Joe Colton as the lead, as the sort of leader of the team. So I had to swallow that and deal with that and my issues, and so that's the fact that I came up with when I thought about this.
And you're telling us it's true, so we're not going to guess.
I'm guessing it's true because you just told us.
we also accept interesting trivia. It doesn't have to be phrased in the form of a true or false trivia.
Oh, see, I misunderstood, because Joe Colton was totally my idea. I was just trying to, you know.
See, you threw us. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
I thought that's what the game was. I apologize. Okay.
You phrased it so clearly in the affirmative. We thought you were just telling us a true fact.
You won. You won, Joe. So Joe Colton was your idea to bring into the team.
Yes.
As the leader figure.
Correct.
So I guess the follow up is why?
Well, I just felt like it hadn't been done to my knowledge. To the extent that I wanted to do it. And I just felt like, you know, he was the original G.I. Joe, and to not use him just seemed weird to me. And I had a take on that kind of character. I wanted to play him as, a more realistic Nick Fury type, sort of old and grizzled, but he was the inspiration for the entire organization. And I thought he worked as a sort of a spiritual figurehead for the team, you know, too old to go into combat, but could definitely lead from the sidelines or from the war room. And I just, you know, taking on the gig, I was looking for new dynamics, new dramatic dynamics, new character dynamics. And that one seemed to me a natural. I mean, you're always looking for things that no one has done before, so you can claim some territory, some new territory, or at least some territory that feels new to your own sensibilities. And that was not a huge one, but that was, that from right off the bat. I mean, that's in my original pitch document that I wanted to bring him in as the leader.
Mm-hmm. Reading between the lines, this is a setup for drama, because if the Joe's established leader gets pushed aside, then they're going to resent Colton, or there may be issues of trust.
Yeah, there's always, I mean, that's part of the character dynamics is, you know, being the inspiration for the team is one thing, but what does he mean in the present day? You know, how are people going to react to him? How are people going to respond? And I'm not one to necessarily sow the seeds of discontent just to stir the pot. I didn't want it to be a situation where you looked at him with, you know, with a side eye. I mean, I tried to write him as a genuine character who, you know, wanted to do the job and do it well. So there was no undercurrent of like, this is a throw a wrench in the system and really stir up some shit. It was more of, it just made sense, and it created that new dynamic that felt fresh and was new territory to explore.
Yeah, because he's a well-established character, but not in that role, that there was a sort of a kind of natural kind of leadership, the role, but without the shorthand of knowing the details of all of the individual characters, so that they're all wanting to do the right thing, but Colton is getting a sense of exasperation that all of these things aren't quite, you know, going in his favor, and would have been, I guess, a different dynamic for an established leader in those relationships.
Yeah, and it's also a sense of, you know, if you're relaunching a series, you're looking for anything that is a way in for potentially a new reader. Mm. And I mean, it's one of the reasons they recruited me for the gig. So I was looking for ways to just new ways in, so that somebody coming in fresh, who might have read my Marvel or DC work but had never read G.I. Joe, would not be thrown. I mean, I guess I felt like, it's a book called G.I. Joe. The cursory reader, or somebody who's just aware of the IP, probably would be looking for, well, where is Joe in G.I. Joe? You know, I mean, there's the organization, but then there's, you know, some awareness that there might have been or should be a G.I. Joe character. So I felt to leave him out was leaving something off the table that should have been there.
Was there anything that you wanted to do that Blaylock said no?
Nothing that was like substantial in its conception. I mean, there's some differences that evolved from what I pitched to what eventually saw print. Let me give you an example here. For instance, in the first storyline, the culprits were going to originally, and this was based on things that Josh had told me about the previous series, which I read the whole thing, but he was telling me things that were possibly loose ends or things that were hanging on that could be picked up. So instead of, what's his name? Vance, who was this guy that I pulled out of the old series, the Larry Hama series, the original
Wingfield.
Yeah. Vance Wingfield. That's right. Which I, for the life of me, I know he's from the old series, but I can't remember exactly where I pulled him from. Early on, I thought, because I wanted that symmetry.
I think it's like issue 4 or so, isn't it?
Issue 4.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Because I wanted that symmetry of like as early of a nemesis as I could find. But so what I was saying is the original antagonist in that story was the Red Shadows, which I didn't know much about, but Josh had told me about a little bit. So in my pitch, I can read right from it. I said, okay, about the Red Shadows. I know Josh said they were introducing them as a mysterious group who's killing both Joes and Cobras. I don't recall seeing them in any of the issues I was sent. So I'm just going on my own ideas what the Red Shadows could be, which sounds like, I think I made the right decision in going back in Larry Hama continuity and finding somebody that was obscure but felt like more of a callback to the early comics.
Also, in the final two issues before you pick up, the Red Shadows are the villains, and maybe the idea was that to bring them in the next month was going to be not enough of a fresh start.
That's probably that
because we
yeah. That's probably the reason why I ultimately didn't do it, because we were talking and the previous series was still in its final phases of production, so that must have been what happened, where I said, hey, the Red Shadows you told me about, and he eventually came and said, yeah, we're going to use them in the last couple of issues. I said, okay, back to the drawing board. I mean, the whole thing about the plot was the same in terms of pulling satellites out of the sky and, you know, dropping them on America, but who was responsible obviously then had to shift.
Did you ever go to Chicago? Did you go to Devil's Due?
No, I did not. You mean the offices?
Yeah.
No.
Did you meet up with them at conventions or do signings or events?
The only sort of G.I. Joe related event that I did, there was a convention in Minneapolis that took place the year the book launched. And it was a G.I. Joe themed convention. I forget what it was called, but they sent me out to that one to pimp the book. And I remember, hung out with Tim Seeley there. He was there. I mean, Minneapolis is pretty close to Chicago. So there was, and Josh was there too, I think. So it was as close, without being a Chicago con, it was probably as close to their hometown con as they could get. And like I said, it was G.I. Joe themed. There was a lot of, you know, stuff there. It was very cool to see in person. I'd never seen, what's the name of the aircraft carrier from back in the day? The big ass toy. I don't remember what it was, but they had
the USS flag.
Yeah. The flag. I'd never seen that in person before. I didn't know anybody that had it, and to see it all built, I remember being fairly impressed. I was like, this is a toy. My God, who has room for this in their house?
So in terms of promotion, so you didn't sign at the Devil's Due booth at other conventions, regular Comic Cons, comic book conventions. It was just that Joe Con.
I think I might have at the San Diego the year that it launched.
Okay.
But I don't remember. I don't recall Devil's Due having much of a booth presence in San Diego. I mean, I'm sure they were there, but it wasn't like, you know, a major setup as far as I remember.
Right.
Okay, so did you prepare any more facts or unfacts, as they're also called, or should we move on to the next thing?
Let's move on. My Joe Colton thing didn't work out so well. I don't want to test my luck.
Okay, so we've started treading on some territory of pitches, but let's rewind. Let's start back at the beginning. So a young Joe Casey, what's his first experience of the G.I. Joe brand? There's out there in the world, there's toys, there's comics, there's cartoons. What did you encounter?
My first encounter was probably, I mean, not probably, but were the toys from the 70s, the big, you know, big action figures. And I remember, it's funny because it all comes from comics. You know, those G.I. Joes were advertised as these one pagers in comics. The one I remember the most was introducing the Intruder, who I then subsequently got one Christmas. So I had a couple of those toys. But I sort of leaned in. I mean, there's no surprise considering how I ended up writing the book. I leaned into the more comic booky aspects. I mean, you know, Eagle Eye G.I. Joe, cool. But I thought the Intruder was cool. I got Bullet Man, who they kind of roped into the G.I. Joe sort of circle, where you could tie the string between two trees, and you know, he had hooks on the back, and he could send him through the air. So I had those as a young kid, and sort of generationally, I was a little, just barely too old for the Hasbro action figures, but my friend who lived down the street, he was all in. So I sort of by proxy experienced the 3/4-inch toys through him. He was way into them, and I thought they were cool as hell, but I was just probably a little too old to buy them myself. I think I had a couple, but he was all in. And then, and that coincided with the cartoon coming out, which, if I'm remembering right, was the first cartoon was a 5-episode thing that was every day after school for a week. I came home and I watched it. It was the one with the, what was it called? The Mass Device. So, you know, I got a kick out of that. And then I would watch the show. Once the show premiered, I'd watch it sort of sporadically. But I was way into that first, that 5-parter. I think I probably, in fact, I know I did. I recorded on VHS. And mainly the thing was, I had seen the commercials. I knew the comic was out there. But it was the first animation I'd seen that looked like a comic book. You know, the art style and sort of the storyline, it felt like a comic. So that sort of drew me to it. And then again, I sort of aged out of the show pretty quickly. But yeah, I have fond memories. I remember maybe a couple years ago, I saw they had posted the Mass Device 5-parter on YouTube. And I realized, you know, it's one of those things where I remembered the first episode just like crystal clear when I saw it. It was like an umbilical cord back to being, you know, 13. But as the episodes went on, as the 5-parter went on, I thought, I don't remember this happening or this happening. So I must have watched that first episode over and over and over again. And my attention span couldn't get me through my VHS copy of the last 4, you know, typical short attention span theater there. But that was kind of those were kind of my first exposures. I read the comic, Larry Hama's comic, sort of sporadically. If I was at the store, at the newsstand, and a cover caught my eye. I remember there was an issue where the Joes were reflected in the Cobra Commander mask. That was early on. So I picked that up. So if something caught my eye, I would read it, but I was just a little too old to sort of dive in with both feet and sort of embrace it. I was more of a Star Wars kid in terms of what hit me at the right moment for the age that I was at. And even then, by the time Return of the Jedi came out, I was like, oh, these goddamn teddy bears, I think I'm done. You know?
And what was your, you know, you sort of sporadically would get G.I. Joe every now and again, but what was your main jam when it came to comics? What was your real, you know, the one that really hooked you in the world of comics?
Well, I started out probably as a Marvel kid. I was a big Avengers guy. I was a big team book guy.
Right.
And in the 80s, it's funny. I was of the generation of where I was just about to probably age out of comics as well. But at that moment, the direct market was exploding and there was a lot of independent work that was out there that kind of kept me hooked. And then 1986 rolls around with Dark Knight and Watchmen and all that. And that kept me around. You know, it's almost like the comics, the superhero comics sort of aged with me and kept me on the line. Like every time I was out, they pulled me back in. And and at that point, it never went away. It just never went away. Thank God I ended up doing it for a living, right?
Absolutely. Was there a moment when you decided you needed to write comics, or was this a gradual thing?
Well, you know, when you're a little kid and you don't know any better and you like comics and you're interested in that form, you know, I was drawing my stick figure comics and they were horrible and I was just trying to, you know, do what I could. At some point, the realization that I was not a very good artist dawned on me, thankfully early on, where I just, both the ability was not quite there and the drive to get better was not there. My laziness gene kicked in and I thought, you know, the thing I loved about comics was the stories anyway and the storytelling. And I was making my own comics, but I was not executing them in the way that I saw them in my head. You know, again, from my head to the pencil was not translating. But I realized that what I was really getting off on was telling the stories. And so at that point, I was differentiating the different jobs within a comic book, the writer, penciler, inker, colorist, letterer, et cetera. And also, again, the direct market was providing a ton of really great, I wouldn't even call them fanzines, but, you know, the Comics Journal, Amazing Heroes, Comics Interview. So I was getting that peek behind the curtain here, you know, being able to read interviews with creators and writers and artists. So I had that interest in the medium and the industry early on, so much so that I was submitting scripts and things to DC and Marvel probably from about 14 years old. I don't know what I was thinking, but I think at one point I wrote a Batman fill-in that I sent to Dick Giordano, who was sort of the editor-in-chief of DC Comics at the time. And he was the one that had kind of brought DC out of the doldrums of the 70s into the 80s in a big way. And, you know, I got the requisite form letter back that said, you know, we can't accept unsolicited submissions and all that. But at the bottom, he hand wrote, you know, we have writers on Batman, obviously, but the script is good. You should pitch something for a new series. And I was 16 at the time, and I really freaked out. I was like, I'm not ready for that. I think I'll just lay low for a while. And I was doing black and white. There was a big black and white explosion in the mid-80s that I was able to tap into on a small press level. So I figured that was a note of encouragement from somebody who didn't know how old I was. And so that kind of, it served as a guiding light. So a couple of years later in my early 20s, I really started to get serious about breaking into the business. And after moving out to Los Angeles, after a couple of years of meeting a lot of other professional creators who were doing it for a living, that was the second peek behind the curtain. When you see guys in the flesh who are doing the job you want to do, it kind of makes it tangible and makes it real. And then they then helped me subsequently get into the business. I broke in at Marvel because I'd met James Robinson and known him for a couple of years. And he basically held the door open for me at Marvel to get in there. And yeah, it's been nonstop ever since.
So yeah, in the Cable volume that I've got sat behind me, you sort of thank James Robinson for largely sort of kickstarting your career and, as you say, sort of holding the door open to get started. And you've got that incredible run on Cable with that sort of astonishing work from Ladron, also starting his sort of career there in Cable. So a sort of a quite a grand start. So How did your career kind of navigate from that sort of those early footsteps into the eyeline of Devil's Due?
Well, I'd done a lot of fairly high profile work fairly quickly. Within the first 5 or 6 years of my career, I'd written Incredible Hulk, I'd written Uncanny X-Men, Adventures of Superman, you know, big franchises. So I was visible, and Josh was starting up a little mini line of superhero comics called, what they had some title.
Aftermath.
Aftermath, that's correct. That's right. Yeah. And so he recruited me to write one of those. I did a book called Infantry. And that was how I got to know Josh, and we got on fairly well. Those books didn't last very long, but we had a good time doing them. And I think from there, he started talking to me about would I be interested in taking on G.I. Joe, which I certainly was. I mean, it wasn't, it was one of those things where, you know, I just went through my history of G.I. Joe. I was not a dyed-in-the-wool, know-everything-about-them fan. I had an awareness of them, and I knew what they meant to people who were those heavy-duty fans. But I was coming at it from, like, I'd done the X-Men, I'd done Superman, I'd had some experience doing these big franchises. So this was another challenge. And, you know, I was attracted to the property. I mean, I saw the value in it, certainly. And I thought, based on they'd sent me the previous run or what had been done up to that point, and when I read through it, I thought, this is really good, but I see an opportunity to do something different or have my own take on the material, which is, you know, what they wanted, I think. I mean, when you get into, it was the first time, I think, since Devil's Due had gotten the property that they were going to do a relaunch of a series. So they were kind of, it was sort of by the numbers and, you know, find maybe a left of center choice to spearhead it, get a fresh take and see if that, you know, juices the sales at all. Because, I mean, that's, in a way, that's kind of what it's all about at the end of the day. What's going to give the sales a boost? And, you know, that's where the zero issue came from and the whole publishing plan that he came up with.
Joe, did you write full script or plot?
I wrote full script because I was not aware of at the beginning. I mean, I think I knew that that Stefano was going to draw it, but I wasn't familiar with his work. I hadn't worked with him before. So I, just to cover my bases, I mean, I tended to work full script anyway. After my first few years at Marvel, I sort of switched over to full script, and for the most part have stayed in that format ever since.
Did you meet Stefano?
I've never met Stefano in person, not at conventions. We've never been at the same convention that I'm aware of. I mean, we'd email back and forth, obviously, once I got the gig. I think he was lined up to do it already when they hired me. Okay. So he and I got on email and got on really well. I mean, we had the same sensibility for what we wanted to do with the book. So it was, you know, I think it was a pretty good partnership.
And yeah, and certainly that issue zero, we were kind of slightly knocked off our feet by it. I think it's fair to say that it's a very cinematic, explosive, literally issue. And the art by Stefano with the coloring does look, it's impressive.
Yeah.
I want to go back to that previous answer, Joe. So the two of you were in line with what you wanted to do with the book. Mm-hmm. So we know about the sort of the theory of make it different, put your own stamp on it. But in terms of not an elevator pitch, but sort of bullet points or maybe feelings, do you recall what the two of you wanted to do with the book?
Well, if you want, I'll read a little bit from the pitch or from my, it wasn't really a pitch. It was sort of my first round of notes to them after I'd come up with, what I wanted to do or what I thought I should do. This is the second paragraph. The way to engage readers again is to play on their affection for the characters and subsequently put them through enough hell that readers feel like real consequences are at stake. I'm not big on military fiction, but I can fake the procedural stuff enough to get by. But as Josh and I discussed early on, I want to downplay the idea of G.I. Joe as being this enormous army and play them more as an elite special forces. A small cast coupled with really involving character-based storylines is the way to go. They're like the ultimate Green Berets. In fact, one of my models' inspiration for this whole thing, oddly enough, is Star Trek. And I'm thinking of a specific era of the movies, namely 2 through 4. In other words, the Harve Bennett, Nicholas Meyer films, two guys who weren't exactly Trekkies when they took on the franchise for Paramount. So that kind of gives you an idea what my mindset going in, how I sort of approached it.
Yeah.
Can I ask, do you know, were you the only person in the running for that relaunch when you were having that early discussion with Josh Blaylock, or do you think he was talking to other writers, you know?
I don't think it was a bake-off once I said I would give it a shot. I mean, I'm sure if I'd have turned in something that was wildly off the mark that they would have moved on. But this document that I was reading from was after conversations with Josh and feeling like, you know, he wanted me to do it. I wanted to do it. He never told me he was talking to other writers, but I don't think anybody else ever wrote anything up to pitch or as a formal document to what their approach would be. So it wasn't quite a bake-off, but I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if he talked to other people. I mean, if I were him.
There's just as kind of the announcement of you coming onto the book at the time, there was a somewhat hilarious interview with Josh from with the YoJo website, where they're, I guess, some they'd sort of take out a quote from an earlier interview of yours, which I guess it sort of comes back and bites you a little bit, that you're talking about the resurgence of 80s properties like Transformers, G.I. Joe, Battle of the Planets, Thundercats, He-Man, and that wave of 80s nostalgia which was sort of coming through. What was your feelings about the movement of all of these books, the wave that was happening at the time?
I mean, I knew as it was happening, there was sort of inevitability that these things come back. I mean, everything is cyclical in pop culture. I would say any more inflammatory things I said back in the day were in service of propping up my persona as a writer in comics at the time. I mean, you got to understand, we were coming out of, at that point, or maybe we're still in it, this what we all affectionately call the writer-driven era of comics, where writers were sort of in the driver's seat of the industry. And so we took full advantage of that. It was our moment in the sun to be listened to. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of theories behind that, you know, why we had that moment, which are probably all valid. But the two that stick out to me is it was a sort of a reaction to the Image Comics era, the initial Image Comics era, which was emphasizing art and artists over writers and stories. So we were taking a little bit of that back. And also it sprung out of the advent of the internet in its early days, you know, as you guys probably remember, when everybody was on dial up and there wasn't a lot of bandwidth, the internet was a place where you went and read stuff. You couldn't quite look at art, and the graphics weren't that good. So writers were able to get in there early on and stake their claim, have a real presence on the internet for comic book fandom, where artists, you know, it took a while for the technology to catch up so that artists could scan in their work and, you know, you could, you know, see artwork in its full glory. So we had the leg up in terms of promoting ourselves and creating these personas that served us well in our career, but in retrospect, provide a lot of cringeworthy moments.
I myself am very likely to cringe in a year or 5 years when someone quotes back at me things I have said in this very podcast a year or two ago. I don't know what they are, but I'm getting ready for them.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So when you do interviews, especially back in the day, you'll take a position that will prop up whatever project you're doing. So if I was doing, I might have said that in as I was promoting something that was either creator owned work or a new IP. So in to set that up, I would probably say something like, oh, all this nostalgia is a bunch of crap and what the hell's going on, and we need new ideas, people, and this is one of them, and go out and buy it. So it was always in the service of marketing. And you know, I was young and full of piss and vinegar, so I'm sure I went to that I went to that well more than once.
Excellent.
I'm waiting for the Transformers Godland crossover to bring these two things together.
Sure. We kind of had it, didn't we, with
yeah
Scioli's, yes, Thomas Scioli's series. So yeah, sort of we're still kind of at the pitch stage. Is there any more you can sort of pick out from your pitch document to sort of give the context of what you thought you were going to do as you were going into it?
I mean, I pitched. I know I pitched. Looking at this, I pitched the cast, the duty roster. You know, as a smaller cast of characters, so I picked out the ones that I thought were the most iconic and the most recognizable. Like I said, I had a cursory knowledge of G.I. Joe, so that was my North Star. What were the characters that I knew of just from my general awareness of the characters? So I think, so I say here, based on what I read, as well as Josh's initial notes when he approached me about this, the best G.I. Joe cast would consist of Duke, Flint, Snake Eyes, Scarlet, Stalker, Roadblock, Shipwreck, and Storm Shadow. I said I'd also like to use Hawk, who was still on the injured list in a wheelchair. And then I said, instead of General Ray, I'd like to reinstate General Colton as the main leader of the team. So I knew going in who I wanted to, I wanted on the team, which, you know, they were fine with. I don't think they came back and said, hey, can you use this guy too? Or can you not use that guy? I think that approach of like, who are the most recognizable cast members was pretty, you know, everybody agreed on that.
So after your first arc, Caselli stops drawing the book, mm-hmm. but he sticks around for a few covers. And you have two main collaborators for the second arc and the third arc. Nelson Blake II.
Right.
Am I remembering this correctly, Mark? And then Josh Medors. Did you have interactions with them? You were writing full script. Did you meet them? Did you talk about what you wanted the book to be? Or was it like, oh, here's a new artist. Keep going.
It was more the latter. I mean, at that point, I was probably so far ahead on scripts that it was probably a situation where I was writing for Stefano once we started to lock in the first couple of issues. And then, this happens quite a lot in monthly comics where you're now envisioning one style and one artist that you're sort of getting comfortable with. And you've written several scripts to that artist, probably to the point where I'm in the scripts, I'm going, Stefano, this shot is a wide shot and it gets more personal. And then they say, hey, by the way, Stefano's gone to Marvel, or he's got another gig, or he can't keep up, or whatever the situation was at the time. And you just roll with it. You know, you just fingers crossed, hope for the best. I mean, you know, Josh has pretty good taste in artists. And so I was never worried that whoever he would get would not be able to do the job. And once you've got a couple issues under your belt that have been drawn and published and you've set the tone, you hope, and in this case, I think it proved to be the case, that Nelson and whoever came after would know the style of the book and could just kind of fall in line with what had been established. And that was pretty much the case. I would never get art back and go, what the hell is this? This guy doesn't get it at all. I was pretty satisfied with how the whole run ended up.
I had a question sort of going back almost to the start again, which was that to what extent, if any, do you think that your plans of how you envisioned, like how you wanted to start your book from, fed back into how the previous series ended up? So was the kind of the wrap up of the previous run sort of slightly, you know, trying to direct it into the how you wanted to pick things up? For example, like you know, you've got Flint as a widow with a lot of anger, deservedly so, and that's obviously because of the death of Lady J in the previous run. Was any of that kind of stuff feeding into how you wanted to start things up?
No, I would never do that to another writer. I would never say, please do this because it helps me out. I can tell you this about Lady J, because I'm seeing it in the pitch document. As I was sort of outlining the first storyline, I have a little aside here. It says another continuity note. Josh had said something about Lady J being dead and thus casting Flint into a darker characterization. I hope this is still happening because it definitely gives me more shades to color Flint with. So that was clearly something that they were talking about. I don't know if they had done it yet, or I assume that happened at the end of the run. But yeah. but for me, as a, you know, creatively, I'm looking for those things. Like, what are these? What are the character hooks that are different from the previous run? And that was a situation where he had mentioned it, and I was, you know, all for it, because the purpose that it served for me is it gave me a way into Flint's character. You know, it gave him something to someone to be at the start of my series, and to take him on a journey too. So I was just telling, you know, my feeling, just like that Lady Jane, I was like, just tell me where these guys are, and I'll work from that. You know, tell me what you're putting them through. Tell me how you're ending the series, and however that is, I'll just pick up from there, and I'll lean into it as best I can. And I was grateful about that Flint development, because it did hook me into that character in a way that I wouldn't have previously.
Before issue 13 was published, Devil's Due released a 25-cent issue that had a really short lead story that you didn't write. It was 6 pages and then some text character pages. And it was another hook, you know, a gimmick, but I don't mean that in a negative way, for the market to, you know, shake things up and remind people and maybe lure them back or get them to notice again. And it sets up some story that's going to happen in 13 and after, although it comes out the same month as 11. And again, you didn't work on it, but Mike O'Sullivan, the editor, wrote that story. Do you remember any coordination around that?
You know, I was looking at that early. The only thing I remember about that is that I don't know who was campaigning for it. I'm sure it was Josh that wanted Spirit back in the book in some capacity. So maybe he was a favorite character of his. I mean, who knows? But we'd probably already talked about what the third storyline was going to be. And it was, you know, not a negotiation. I was happy to do whatever he, you know, suggested if I thought it made sense. I mean, if it didn't, I would try to talk him out of it. But that never really happened as far as I remember. So I think that was, it was a situation where he wanted to use Spirit. How do we get him in? I might have, you know, we might have had a phone call or an email exchange about like how it could be done. I don't recall having much input into that story. Again, with the Flint thing, I was more of a sense of, okay, you want to use Spirit. He seems cool. How would you want to bring him into this? And then once we sort of maybe spitballed some ideas, but I'm sure it mostly came from them. And it, just like with Flint, I said, okay, then if that's what you're going to do to bring him back, or you're going to do this story, then that can inform how I feed him back into the main storyline. So it was, you know, it was pretty collaborative, but I was, again, I would always defer to Josh and the editorial team, because, you know, I knew what I was there to do. I knew why I was there. It was not to be the G.I. Joe expert. So whenever they could always, you know, lay that card down of like what they felt as fans was going to be best for the readers, you know, because I did know that, and it turned out to be the case after I left the book, I knew that keeping that tight, small, focused cast, I was only gonna be able to hold on to that for so long. When fan response and fan, not now pressure in a good way, not bad pressure, but you know, it was inevitable that you'd hear feedback like, well, what about this character? What about that character? So I knew that I could only keep the thing tight and focused for just so long. So when they would come to me and say, you know, in this case, we want to get Spirit back in the book, I didn't have any problem. I knew those things were inevitable. So I did the best I could with it. And, you know, Spirit's a cool character. I mean, he's individualistic within the whole roster. So I don't recall there wasn't any fighting back on that decision at all.
We're talking about editorial coordination, and another example that we picked up on as we were reading through was there's the major blood issue where he's having a fight with Storm Shadow on the top of the Sydney Opera House. And in passing, he mentions that he's killed a G.I. Joe, which isn't then followed up within the main book. But then Mike O'Sullivan writes a story in Special Missions. So we were guessing that possibly this was something that Mike asked to be included so that he could then follow it up on one of these side stories.
I'm sure that was the case. And I it's funny because that was, I didn't do much with him, but for some reason, even from when I was a kid, I loved Major Blood. I don't know why. Just something about that character kind of spoke to me in some weird kind of way. I mean, him and Destro, I thought, because they were coming out of superhero comics, they were the most sort of super villain-esque. I mean, at the time, it got wilder later. I'm well aware. Yeah. But at in those early days, in terms of the action figures in the comics, those were the bad guys that kind of caught my interest. So I didn't do enough with him that I think I probably wanted to do.
Major Blood also makes some big appearances in those first five animated episodes of G.I. Joe.
Yes, that's true.
And so as present as he is in the comic and as bold as the visual is for his toy package and his toy, he's got this great accent and he's got this high-pitched voice and he kidnaps the scientist and ties him to a tree and disguises himself as him and tears the mask off and welcomes the Joes and starts shooting them.
Yeah, he's great.
Another sort of slightly left field character that appeared early in the run was Cesspool, who wasn't very used very often in the comics or the media. And he's sort of unwell. He's in bed and he's been cared for by, I think, his wife, and he's being investigated by Scarlet. And they come across these creepy robot children who incapacitate Scarlet, and she's captured and passed on to Destro. So there's a great, one of my favorite characters that makes an appearance there in Cesspool, but that sort of plot line doesn't get followed up. Was that something that was originally intended to be bigger, or was it just one of these sort of side quests?
Well, I mean, it's probably more of a side quest. I mean, when you write long form superhero narratives, I mean, this is how I learned how to do it. You put in breadcrumbs that you will hopefully follow up later, and things like that. They serve sort of an immediate story purpose, but you're also laying track that if you want to come back to it, it's sort of there for you. And the one thing I liked about writing G.I. Joe is that as much as I wanted to focus the cast and have it be smaller and more manageable, I realized that what I had here was basically what now we all call the shared universe concept, which is that's all out there that you can cherry pick concepts that work for the story beat that you're trying to get across, or just like you say, story tangents that are interesting and let readers know that have really been following all along that I was not throwing out everything for the sake of my own ego. So, and I like that stuff where I have a story idea. I mean, in that case, I probably had the plot mechanics in place, and I would go to Josh in this case and say, what's a character that sort of fits this role that I need that would be a nice shout out to the diehards out there. And, he would not hesitate to be able to provide somebody. So I think that's probably where that Cesspool whole thread came from.
So you were talking about the pitch doc, and I think if I'm understanding correctly, that the first two arcs were essentially laid out fairly closely, which is, I guess, the satellite storyline and the Joes ultimately defeating that, and then the second one was the sort of the death and resurrection of Snake Eyes.
Yeah.
Did you stick relatively closely to that original pitch?
Well, aside from, I'm looking at it right now. I outlined the first, keep in mind, this was before there was a Zero issue. So my issue one that I pitched ended up becoming the Zero issue. So I had the first three issues fairly laid out. And then there's a section that says, this basically says issue four and beyond, which I sort of encapsulate things and summarize things fairly generally. But it has, and some of the things with like the Snake Eyes story, the second storyline, there were details in there that I'm sure changed. But the overall movement of the story was pretty laid out. I'm looking at it right now. I also had the in along with the Snake Eyes death, I had the whole Duke tracks down. What was it? I've got it here pitched as a former Crimson Guard gone rogue.
I heard you refer to this as the sort of Heart of Darkness or Apocalypse Now arc of the book, which I thought, yeah, which we didn't really pick up on when we're talking about, but absolutely makes sense.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. I mean, I'm a huge fan of that movie, and so that was a way to scratch that creative itch, you know. And I thought it turned out fairly well. I mean, it kept. That was definitely an aim to kind of do a story like that. I think I pulled it off as well as I could at the time.
That's kind of where your pitch got to in terms of the thinking. And then I guess once you'd got to the end of that story, you're kind of thinking, what is then Act 3?
Yeah, well, I mean, in terms of the pitch document, once you pitch, you know, the death of a major character, you wonder if that's going to fly. So I probably just didn't go much further beyond that, thinking if they shut this down because of that, then what's the point of doing it? I know, cause I know I didn't have the idea of Cobra Commander, you know, infiltrating the White House until I was into my run. Cause you know, you get emboldened by what you're able to pull off. You know, when they say, yes, you can kill Snake Eyes. And I was like, oh, all right, then what else can we do? You know? So that's probably how that third storyline came about.
Yeah, unlike like the death of Superman though for Snake Eyes, it was a fairly short lived death. We didn't have years without the Snake Eyes and multiple pretender Snake Eyes or anything like that.
It's only 1 year, Mark. Superman dies in November 92.
It felt like a long time.
Story start up again in March, and by the summer or the fall, he's back. There is a resemblance in that both stories have the character die and then their bodies are stolen. But anyway.
Yeah, I wanted drama, but I didn't want to. One of the sort of strikes against long form narratives is when you have stories drag out too long. That's death. And usually that happens when you don't have an ending, or you don't have a way to resolve the things you've set up. But I did know how this was going to play out. So I figured, you know, I knew that Snake Eyes was basically the most popular character, and that to take him off the table for too long would have not served the book well. It would not have served fans well. It would not have served sales well. And I had not scenes that kind of death of, you know, take your pick character done like this, where it was just one story. You know, it was just, you know, very tight six issues of, you know, conflict and resolution. And because I, you know, it's a gimmick. Let's be honest. I mean, the death of a character is a gimmick. It's there to goose interest and goose sales. So I knew that going in, but I knew what I didn't want to do was drag it out in any way and you know, extend the misery that anyone would have of having their favorite character or maybe the most popular character dead and off the table for too long.
That arc sort of lent very much into one side of G.I. Joe comics, which is the sort of the mystical ninja side, the almost the superhero side of the ninjas. And then yeah, at the end of the arc, the pendulum swings very much the other way, and it's established, you know, Snake Eyes is going to be now a commando on the other side of the spectrum, the more sort of military realistic side of the spectrum. Was that kind of intentional to please different sort of sides of the G.I. Joe audience?
Well, I mean, I hope if that was the case, it was that then that's a good side benefit. But it was mainly for my own take on the flexibility of a good IP. You know, the first storyline is very, you know, it's character based. It has to do with a guy settling an old score, but I hesitate to say it's grounded in reality, but I mean, it wasn't so fanciful that you stretched your ability to believe in what was going on. So then the way to follow it up is to go in the opposite direction and go for things that are very, you know, mystical and spiritual. And like you said, tap into that side of the franchise, which is there with Snake Eyes and Storm Shadow. And then from there, going to heavy, sort of a political thriller, basically, with a, you know, sort of, you know, Assault on Precinct 13 kind of vibe as well, you know. So it was all about, for me, not proving, because I didn't need to prove it, and it's certainly been proven way before me, but that the flexibility of a franchise is a sign of its staying power, you know. And if you look at things like Superman, Batman, you know, Spider-Man, they've gone through different interpretations, different types of stories, which only proves their durability. And that's so my background in superhero comics, that was, I wanted to apply that mentality to the G.I. Joe book as best I could. And so I hope that readers didn't feel like they were being, you know, slingshot from one extreme to another, but it all fit to me. It was all of a piece, because the characters are so varied that it lends its way into different types of stories. I mean, that's the tenet of a team book. If you're doing a team book of any kind, you want a roster that allows you access to different genres of story. And so I looked at the roster that I picked, and I realized, okay, I've got, just from this small cast of characters, I've got access to different types of stories. So that was sort of the thinking behind what we're talking about there.
Joe, when did you know that you were done?
I think after doing that Phoenix Guard story and juggling all those characters, that I think I was probably burnt out. And I knew, like I said before, I knew that they were on the road to expanding the cast anyway. That's what they wanted. And I just thought, well, I mean, I could stick around and try to make that work, but that was not what I signed up for, you know. And it was not, there was no bad feelings. I mean, like I said, I knew it would eventually go there, because after a year and a half of one approach, one sort of set of storytelling values, it's only natural that you want to shift gears and go somewhere else with it. And if I recall, they had the general notion of where they would like for it to go already. I mean, so the conversations would start out like, hey, we're thinking about, what do you think about this type of story? What do you think about this? We had this idea that we wanted to run by you. And just from the idea, I realized, you know, they wanted to blow it out a little more than I had been doing. And I felt like with the third storyline, with a whole nother team of characters that were going to come in and invade the Rock, and you know, to juggle all that was pretty, you know, after having written the book for a year and to go into that storyline, it was a mountain to climb. And once I'd climbed it, I was like, whew, I'm not sure if I want to climb another mountain. And especially when the prospect of, well, how about this bigger mountain that you can climb now? I thought, it's best to leave it in more capable hands than mine to do that kind of a story. Because, you know, the last thing I'd want to do to any IP that I don't own is to stick around longer than I'm useful. So I felt like, you know, I probably also didn't have an idea that I was going to fight for that matched the three stories that I'd done. I felt like, you know, I'd left it all on the field, and to sort of just dredge up the enthusiasm to do something that I didn't have the passion to do was not going to do anybody any good. And especially the readers who were, you know, who are still around and had stuck with the book for not even before my run.
Did you have a sense that readers were responding to your run either favorably with letters or, you know, email or message board comments? Do you have a sense that sales were good, going up, going down?
I think sales were okay, but, you know, not, I mean, after 18 issues, you know, it's the laws of attrition apply to almost any series that's, you know, of that nature. And as far as fan response, anytime you take on a sort of a beloved IP, you've got to be ready for the slings and arrows of that dedicated fan base. I'd been through it already with the X-Men. I mean, that was a gauntlet unlike anything I'd ever experienced before. So my skin had thickened up by that point. So, I mean, I recall it being a fairly balanced response between people who liked it and people who didn't like it. But again, I was expecting that. I mean, the thing about my general take on the concept of fame is that you can count on if a million people know who you are, that's fame. But within that million people, you can pretty much guarantee that half a million like you and half a million hate you. That's the nature of fame. Fame is not a popularity contest. It's an awareness contest. But awareness is all about, stirring up as much, just as much controversy as you are engendering loyalty. And with a big franchise like G.I. Joe, I knew that there was just as much hate watching as there was, people being into what I was doing. But that comes with the dinner, I mean, I knew that going in. It's kind of part of the fun. I mean, you don't want to deliberately outrage anybody, but if you're doing the job right, you're going to outrage some people, and the worst thing that can happen in any kind of, franchise writing is apathy, is indifference. So you go in going, okay, if people are going to scream and shout, that's better than silence. I'll take that over silence any day. And so there was some screaming and shouting, but it wasn't overwhelming one way or the other. I would say it was a pretty even split as far as what I was paying attention to. Now, I might have not been paying as close attention as, Josh, for instance, but my sense of it was pretty even split.
You mentioned towards the beginning of this that, with the age of the writer, that possibly some of your fans who weren't G.I. Joe fans might follow you onto the book. Did you get a sense of how the non-Joe fans who sort of came on along with you responded to your work on this particular book?
I think the fans that liked it, that were new to it, I was delivering what they were used to in terms of story dynamics and format. I mean, it was, like I said, I approached it in terms of character dynamics as a superhero team book. That was my expertise. So I felt like I was delivering on that front. So the new readers were getting what they were looking for in that respect. And I grew pretty close to the characters. I mean, the reading characters is one thing. When you actually get your hands on them and are writing them, it's a whole nother kind of relationship. So the other reason I left when I knew that they wanted the cast to expand is that I knew that in doing that, I would not be able to give the attention to the focused cast that I came in on. And I've grown very fond of those characters. I felt like I was close to them. I knew them well, and I didn't want to dilute my relationship with those characters that I'd built up over a year and a half, 2 years, with having to bring in, more characters and have to give them the proper attention. And it just, for me as a writer, it dilutes the thing that I came in to do, which was smaller cast, focused characterization, and hopefully get people on board with, I wanted fans of, Stalker, for instance, which was to me one of the original guys. I wanted those fans to feel like they were rewarded for if they stuck in there when there were times where, Stalker wasn't very prominent, which, would happen with a large cast. So I was trying to be, sort of faithful to those fans of those characters, because I had grown to be fans of those characters. I mean, that's one reason I picked them out, not just because the awareness on a sort of pop cultural level, but as I had read the previous run, I've gravitated towards those characters. I was fans of those characters too,
And looking at the overall set of, I guess, 19 issues in total, how do you think it fits into your overall body of work? And is there a particular thing that you think worked best and maybe something that you think in retrospect didn't work as well?
Well, and looking over the stuff that I did to prep for this conversation, I was sort of struck by just kind of what I said before. I felt like I did dig into the characters that I chose to work with in a fairly substantial way, and not having that deep fan love, which, you know, your mileage may vary. Sometimes I can look at that as like, oh, it's beneficial, you know, because I'm not beholden to anything that's maybe not appropriate for what I'm trying to do because I have such a fan mentality about it. Or I can look at it as like, I'm just a tourist here and I'm, you know, not quite the diehard that maybe some of the readers would like me to be. But I think overall it's, you know, I'll say this, I give myself credit for not sticking around when I would have been out of my depth. You know, I exerted a rare bit of self-control and saying, when I got to the end of the third storyline, I was like, I think I'm tapped out. I think I've done the best work that I could do with under the circumstances that I brought in. So I'm pretty happy with it on a creative level. I'm sure that, you know, even now, you know, 17, 18 years on, my run is just a blip on the radar. You know, I mean, Larry Hama is the architect of this franchise, and everybody knows that. I was under no illusions that I would ever come close to the impact that he had and still has. So once, you know, and I didn't even really worry about it. You know, Larry is the man, and he will always be the man. So once you can set aside that notion, it really frees you up to just kind of do the gig the best you can and not worry about what your lasting impact or legacy is in. I mean, I'm to be perfectly honest, I'm surprised you guys are reading and reviewing these things. There's so much other things that probably would be more beneficial to your listeners and your demographic and all that. But it's, you know, it's, I mean, I appreciate that you're doing it, but I'm under no illusions that what I did was just one small link in the chain.
That's great. Do you conventions? Do you make appearances?
I did. I was at San Diego this past year. I had a project that was announced. So when I mean, sort of post pandemic, I've been a lot more, you know, conservative about my traveling, especially to conventions. But I'm hoping that, I have more work in comics now than I've had in the past 5 years or so. So I'm probably going to be doing more conventions in the future just to promote that work. But I mean, I love doing them. So I mean, I don't have an anti-convention bone in my body.
That's a good segue. So TV work can be more glamorous. It pays better. You work in TV and also in comics. So what brings you back to comics, or why do comics when you can do TV?
Love of the game. I mean, they're my first love. They're my longest love. They're probably the longest relationship I've ever had in life is with comic books. And they've served me well. I mean, I've said this many times. I don't need them to love me back because therein lies madness. But it's one of those things where they hooked me at such an early age and not necessarily the content as much as the medium. It's like, you know, there's that line in Good Will Hunting where the guy's describing Mozart just looked at the piano and just knew how to play. And it's sort of a similar thing. It was love at first sight from when I was 5 years old. I got this medium. I understood it. I mean, I knew I was going to study it and learn about it. But, you know, comics are a thing where even adults who come to it, you hear those stories about how do I read these things? Which balloon do I read first? Which picture do I look at first? That's, you know, it's amazing that anybody has those issues, but I know that they exist. For me, it was just the opposite. From a very young age, I felt like this was the language that I spoke best. And so it's a lifelong passion. It's a lifelong relationship. When TV work or other parts of the entertainment business take me away from comics, it's very painful. It's very, I long for them when I'm not doing them. And that's why just recently I've gotten back into them in a big, bad way on several fronts. I mean, I've always kept my hand. I've been doing creator owned stuff through Image all along the way, but that would end up being, you know, maybe a mini series or two a year. And certainly in the past couple of years, I've had not much work out at all. But that's because I've been sort of woodshedding and writing comics like they're going out of fashion. So over the next couple of years, you're going to see a lot of stuff with my name on it, for better or worse, on the stands. And I couldn't be more thrilled. I mean, it's like there were times, and sometimes G.I. Joe was this way too, where it was hard work to get into that IP and to study it and to get familiar with it and to focus it and to do what I tried to do with it. It was not just a walk in the park. But now I've done enough work and I've been through enough scenarios in the business and in the industry that it's such a pleasure now to write comics that I couldn't imagine ever giving it up, as long as, I mean, and the beauty of it is, I mean, right now I'm doing a lot of stuff for DC and other publishers where it's more of a work for hire situation. But my deal with Image Comics is that they pretty much let me do whatever I want in terms of creator own work. So I'm just in such a privileged position of, if I have an idea, I can execute it. I can put it out there for the world to see, with no filter. So that's, I've worked in this business 25 years to get to that point. So now to go back to things like, I'm doing a book for DC Comics that'll be coming out next year, a General Zod monthly series. It's coming out of the Superman office. It's just pure fun. You know, my career doesn't depend on any one gig to make or break me. So I'm just having the best time I've ever had writing comics just in the last couple of years.
This series is drawn by Dan McDade.
Yes. Yes. Called Kneel Before Zod, which has some pop cultural significance, I think.
is the series that was announced this summer, or are there any current or immediately upcoming comics projects that you want to tell us and our audience about?
Well, I just put out the first issue of a creator-owned miniseries from Image called Junior Baker, The Righteous Faker, which is a sequel series to a book I did about 12 years ago called Butcher Baker, The Righteous Maker. And this is sort of a continuation of that concept. And then I'm doing a book for Image, which takes an old character called Dutch from the original Youngblood series.
From Team Youngblood.
Exactly. Team Youngblood. And bringing him into the present day. It's sort of a, you know, what happened to Dutch 30 years later, which then will spin out into another book coming next year, which has not been announced yet, but will revisit the original shared Image universe in a different way. So that'll be next spring. And then Kneel Before Zod starts in January. And then there's a couple other things that have already been written, but are working with artists that, let's just say, need a lot of lead time. So just, you know, just waiting for those things to get drawn and then we'll put them out.
Right.
So people are going to be sick of me, man. This time next year, oh my God.
I don't think people will be sick of you. A question which I had, this is the perfect question since we're out of time and since it's not on G.I. Joe. A question that I wanted to ask, which is a terrible interview question and reveals me as not any kind of writer or journalist or, you know, interviewer.
I'm intrigued.
Just some fan. The question which I mentioned to Mark before you got on, my question to you would be, how was your Wildcats so awesome? And that just reminds me of whenever I go to a film festival or a convention and the questions are not screened beforehand. And sometimes that kind of question comes from a young person or someone who hasn't been to a lot of conventions or someone who doesn't know good Q&A etiquette. Because sometimes, you know, young people, they see their hero. I've seen this with students. And the question is sort of a variation of, where do you get your ideas? How are your ideas so good? How can I have your good ideas? Hire me. And it's cute and embarrassing. But I was thinking, it's like, well, I'm not going to have any time to ask about Wildcats. But I do know that it was really awesome. So maybe it's not a question, maybe it's a statement. So I'll just amend that statement and say, I liked the epilogue that showed up in the Intimates, and I would have enjoyed more after year three. And I had dropped G.I. Joe when you came on, and when you came on, I came back. And so, you know, it worked. I was really intrigued. I had been following some of your stuff, and you know, Mark and I were in our reread in 2023. We're both dazzled all over again by issue zero.
Oh, well, thanks, man. Well, see, it worked. Thank God. Well, now Josh can sleep easy thinking it wasn't a complete misstep to getting me on the book.
I mean, you know, the series that you relaunched ran for 36 issues. It ran for a good year and a half after you.
Yeah, so, it's pretty good.
You know, as you know, publishers and series need relaunches in the cycle of attrition. It did work.
Yeah.
Mark, I'm gonna pass the mic to you because I think I'm done.
Yeah, I mean,
I got in my question.
Yeah, well done. Yeah, I didn't see an answer coming out of that question, but
I'm not sure what the question was. Question, how is Wildcat so awesome? Yeah. I'll answer quickly. The bar was not high on Wildcats. generally.
I mean, Alan Moore had written a year of
Oh yeah,
but I do understand. I take.
I mean, generally, by and large, the bar was not high. But yes, you're right. And I wouldn't have even thought about Wildcats if James Robinson and Alan Moore hadn't written it. They totally legitimized it for me. And just as a part two to that, the one thing in comics that even back then was hard to come by was a recognizable character or team or concept that had not been already revamped several times or sort of refocused. And as a kid growing up, that was a big deal for me. Like Alan Moore on Swamp Thing, Frank Miller on Daredevil, Walt Simonson on Thor, taking these, you know, longstanding IP and putting a new coat of paint on them is part of the comic book landscape. It's, you know, certainly in the mainstream where it's all work for hire and you're standing on the shoulders of giants, but you're putting your spin on something. You know, by then there weren't that many of those left, which is why in my career, that's why I take on those challenges like Wildcats, like G.I. Joe. I've done a run on Youngblood. I'm that fulfills that need from when I was a kid of like, wow, wouldn't it be, look what Frank Miller did with Daredevil. That character was going nowhere. And he came in with a fresh take and the skill to really put that book on the map after 15 years of being off the map. So that's just, it's like one of the many facets of this job that you can do that indulges your sort of childhood fantasies about what it'd be like to do the job. So Wildcats was definitely one of those situations where here's a known property that has had its ups and downs, but not ever really a total facelift. So here's a chance to do what my heroes did when I was a kid. And so, you know, that's every so often when I get a chance to do that, I'll generally take the opportunity because they're fewer and further between the longer these things go.
Stuff. So I think we're in the wrap up stage. So massive thanks to Joe Casey joining us, and as always when we do these kind of things, it's fascinating to kind of get the behind the scenes direct and kind of understand the things that, you know, we're sort of speculating as we're reading along about where some of these ideas are coming from, what the events are that are surrounding them. So it's it kind of really adds an extra layer on for me as we're sort of digging into this stuff. And if you, as the audience, enjoyed this and you're new to us, you can check us out over at talkingjoe.com. UK. That's the website. It's got links to all of our things. We're doing a deep dive look back at the America's Elite era, which is why we've been talking to Joe. So you join us for more of that and more besides.
I can't wait to hear you guys tear apart the rest of the run.
I think there's a trajectory. We just for preparation of this finished our reread. I really like the way that the how things ended up, but yeah, we'll get into detail of that on a separate show.
Tim. I had a thought yesterday for the first time that I would like to see Hasbro make Phoenix Guard figures. Hmm.
Well, I don't get a piece of that, so I could care less.
Mark, is this where you ask Joe if he has any places, etc.?
Yeah, true. Yes, Joe. We've talked about some of the things coming up, so hopefully the listeners will check out some of your upcoming work as it lands. But is there a place that you'd want to direct people to on the interwebs to find out more about you and your work?
Well, I mean, manofaction.tv is the company site. I'm not really a big social media guy. So I'm not on Twitter. Man of Action has a Twitter account. Man of Action has an Instagram account, and promotional things will pop on there, but you'll never know what I had for breakfast on any given day.
And Tim, where can people find you when you're not talking to me about G.I. Joe?
Video essays on TV and film at our YouTube channel, which is Atomic Abe Productions, or at Atomic Abe. My brick and mortar comic book shop is Hub Comics in Somerville, Massachusetts, and I write about G.I. Joe at arealamericanbook.com.
So that just leaves me to say once again to thank you to Joe for joining us. And as we sign out, Tim will remind us all that...
Joe, there's an 87 or 88, the TV ads for the toys had a certain jingle, and we've appropriated it for the end of our show.
Right on.
So it goes like this. Cue me up again, Mark.
And as we come to a conclusion, it just leaves Tim to remind you that...
Nobody beats Talking Joe, an international podcast!
Laters. That's us done.
Right on. That was fun.